I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Hi, I'm Shersha Mizan from Hudson. You are listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM. Thank you.
Name, Patty Boom. Host of Vinyl Freedom. Where? WGXC. When? Every first and third Tuesday from 12:10 to 2 p.m. What? Streaming online at WGXC.org. What? Tune in for a genre shakedown, all kinds of choice cuts of wax for you and yours to listen to. Dig it.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Rhodes Adler of Hudson, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the stations.
Supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years. Offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Rhodes Adler of the New York. Any supporter?
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. The show is Good Night, Norman, on WGXC Freeform Radio, coming to you live from Hudson, New York. Tonight I'm going to read a story I didn't finish reading, I don't think, last week by my dear friend and stellar writer, Javisa Woods. Javisa organized a reading that I'm going to do on the 16th of this month, June 2022, in New York City, at a place called the Book Bar, not far from our old stomping grounds where we met many moons ago, Lower East Side of New York. The Book Bar, Thursday, June 16th. This story is from the collection called Tiny Nightmares. Very short tales of horror, edited by Lincoln Michelle and Nadshieli Nieto. It's a really good book. If you like spooky stories, tales of horror, whatever you want to call them, that's what they're called on the cover here. There are a lot of them, and they're short, and many of them are very good. But this one is, like I said, by Javisa Woods. It's called Pipeworks. Sometimes trees look like men. In the dim light of dusk, when they sway in the wind from a distance, the white trees especially stand out against the forest edge. They appear to be a slim man, watching and waiting for something unknown so that he can begin his brutal work. When I was very young, I used to see things that no one else saw. One of the things I saw often was a faceless man with a head of bushy white hair. He watched me through windows. I thought he was a real man, following me around, just to stare and disappear. I saw many things that other people didn't see. I also heard things that other people didn't hear, and sometimes I heard things that other people did hear, but I interpreted them very differently than others would have. I was 5 years old when I discovered the deep, smoldering pipeworks. My mother and I were living with a woman named Susan, whom my mom had known since high school. Susan lived in a small one-bedroom trailer in the next town over from mine. She had a 2.5-year-old son, and she was an alcoholic, as was my mother, but Susan was sloppier about it than my mom. She was a very violent and argumentative drunk. In her one-bedroom trailer, Susan had a queen-sized bed, boasting an ornate metal headboard and frame. When she got drunk and started arguing with the people she often had over for drinking and arguing, I would go into the bedroom, crawl up in the bed, cover one ear, and press the other against the metal headboard. By pressing my ear against the metal poles, I could hear it. The sonorous metal poles produced a mournful and straining racket that sounded like a combination of an old ironworker's shop and a torture chamber. The fairy tale movie Legend, which I loved, included many scenes depicting an upper level of hell, where trolls and demons lived in a nightmarish factory just below the earth, where they were constantly hammering metal and grinding steel and burning coal and torturing the creatures they caught and dragged down and imprisoned in their metal cages. I thought I was hearing this sort of thing. That in some supernatural dimension, the poles of Susan's bed frame led all the way down to a horrible mythical pit in the earth, some deep, smoldering pipeworks, where weapons were being forged from flame and iron, and people were being raped and burned and pulled apart limb by limb, skinned alive, boiled in giant metal cauldrons and branded with Satan's iron. One night when I was staying with my mother, Susan went out to the bars with some friends of hers, and my mother and I stayed home to babysit Susan's 2.5-year-old son. We had a nice time that evening, passing many hours playing games and eating snacks. My mother, myself, and Susan's young son were sitting on the floor of the trailer, and Susan came in slurring and wobbling and talking loudly. She smiled at us and asked if we'd had a good time. Then she sat in a chair near me and held her arms open to her baby boy. "Come here," she said. "Give Mommy a hug." The boy squealed and threw his hands out, laughing, and ran not to her but to my mother, Gina. He crawled up to my mom's lap and turned back to his mom. "No," he squealed, still giggling. "Gina!" Then he hid his face in my mother's chest and laughed like a cartoon baby who was being ornery. He was obviously trying to play, but Susan's response was brutal. Her expression dropped suddenly. Her eyes became dark, her mouth a stiff line. "You love her more than me?" she asked, not playing in any way. "Do you want her to be your mom now? Is that it?" She grabbed him out of my mom's lap and sat him in the middle of the floor. The boy began crying. My mom told her to calm down. "You're just drunk. He knows you're his mama. We've just been having fun, is all," she pleaded. She walked around and sat on the floor across from my mom with her son sitting in between them. She looked at that 2.5-year-old boy who still wobbled when he walked, and she told him, "You're gonna have to choose. You want me or her? You fucking choose who you love more. You hear me? You go to who you love more." "Susan, stop it. This is sick," my mom demanded. I crawled up onto the chair and curled my knees to my chest. "You better choose right, boy," she told him menacingly. "Now call him." My mom sighed deeply and a sorrowful look took over her face. She shook her head and remained silent. "Come here," Susan shouted. "You better get over here, boy. Come to your fucking mama." Susan was screaming at this point, so of course the child was terrified, and even though she wasn't even calling him, he went as fast as he could back into my mother's arms. Then Susan stood, grabbed the toddler by his arm and gave him 3 very hard smacks in the face. My mother screamed at her and reached for the boy, but Susan quickly grabbed him by his hair and began dragging him out of the living room and down the hall toward the bedroom as he screamed for his life. I can still see him. It's like a short video that goes in a loop whenever I think of it. I can see his face twisted up in anguish, his feet barely touching the ground, facing me with his hair tangled in his mother's fist as she dragged him behind her down the brown carpeted hallway so she could lock herself in the bedroom with him and beat him all she liked until he learned to love her more. My mom leaped to her feet, sprinted down the hallway, and got to Susan before she reached the bathroom. They began scuffling, and my mother beat Susan back into the living room with a series of shoves and punches, taking a couple of hard smacks to the face herself. The boy was left in the hallway crying. "Calm the fuck down," my mom screamed at Susan as she shoved her so hard that she toppled backward, landing on the couch. My mother turned and scooped me up and took off running down the hallway with me. Susan got up from the couch and came after us, shouting curses as she came. My mom let me down and told me to run to the bedroom so she could scoop up Susan's young son. "Run, sissy, run," she shouted as she ran fast behind me with the boy in her arms. We made it into the bedroom and my mom slammed the door just as Susan landed on it and began slamming her full body into it. "He's my son, you bitch," Susan screamed. "I'll kill you, you little bitch. I'll fucking kill you when I get my hands on you." She kept pounding on the door and screaming about the horrible things she wanted to do to us. Mom got on the bed with us and took the boy. I curled up beside her against the bed frame, covered one ear with the palm of my hand, and pressed my other ear to the paranormal metal headboard. I heard a man lift a hammer and bring it down, and someone wail as a machine creaked out its ghastly work. I heard people pounding on the walls to be let out of the dungeons and imagined what crimes they were being punished for and who would escape and who would perish in the flames of fire. I heard a young couple whispering their final goodbyes as the wooden racks they were tied to were lifted and poured into the pit of flame and reveled in the creak and pop of the metal and wood and flesh and bone as it was eaten by fire. I stayed there like that, curled next to my mother, my ear pressed against the bedpost, drowning out Susan's screaming and threatening with the entrancing and oddly comforting sounds of that subterranean torture chamber. Tiny Nightmares. The Pipeworks by Shavisa Wood. It's a recent book and a good one. Check out her own other book of short stories. I don't think I'm supposed to plug it. Things to Do When You're Goth in the Country. An amazing, amazing collection of stories. Very much unlike the story that I'm about to read, which is probably set in the other version of Whiteylandia, we know as America. This is by David Gates, who was a teacher and writer and professor of a late friend of ours who left this planet young, Jade Sharma, who wrote one novel, or published one novel. She wrote a lot more stuff besides that. And then left us while she was working on her follow-up. She was a good friend of Shavisa and I, and David Gates, who I'm going to read now, was her professor and mentor. This is from his collection of stories called The Wonders of the Invisible World, published by Alfred Knopf. In 1999. This story is called The Crazy Thought by David Gates. The Crazy Thought. The year was round, a millstone turning slowly clockwise, and even on this Friday afternoon in August, Faye could feel it moving down toward Christmas. There were points on the circumference whose approach she always dreaded. Ben's birthday and their wedding anniversary, both in June and safely passed this time around. Her own birthday in January, when he was likely to call or send a card. May 21st, the projected birthday of their aborted child. October 17th, the day it died. They were like the song she must never listened to, Devoted to You, or These Foolish Things, or The Long and Winding Road. She had been able to date the conception exactly because it had been the only time for weeks. She had wept afterward, and Ben was put off, probably understandably. The next week, he moved out and never touched her again. When she went through her mystical thing about it, both her shrink and her sister Karen had explanations. She had gone off the pill because it was killing her, to increasingly little purpose, and having sex with him that afternoon was a fleeting self-destructive impulse. But lately she hadn't been bothering to fight away mystical ideas. At this point, what harm could they possibly do? Karen had called Wednesday night out of the blue to ask if she and Alan could come over for the weekend. And would it be at all possible to pick them up in Burlington if they took a plane Friday evening? Because if they rented a car, it looked like they couldn't possibly get there until after midnight. Not a problem, Faye told her, if they didn't mind Paul coming to get them in the truck. The car was in the shop, and she still hadn't learned to drive a stick. A truck? Karen had said. Alan will be thrilled. I'm always thrilled when people are thrilled, Faye had said. The car was in the shop because after front-end work to the tune of $400, they couldn't afford to get it out. Faye had never met the new husband. In the wedding pictures, he looked like a pretty standard product, Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters. Well, why not? Karen had relocated to L.A. just after Faye had moved into Paul's place on Late Street, and she'd married Alan around the time Faye and Paul had clinked glasses at the Ear Inn to toast their plan. Paul would quit teaching and make the down payment on the farmhouse they'd found, and Faye would take the newspaper job in Burlington while he stayed home and wrote. By the time Karen talked Alan into moving back to New York, Faye and Paul had been up here for 2 years, during which time Faye got laid off and Paul began working for the town. Then another year just sort of went by. Faye and Paul never left Vermont, and Karen and Alan both had new jobs and couldn't always get away on weekends. When Alan had surgery on the knee he'd damaged playing squash, Faye almost went down to lend moral support, but let Karen talk her out of it. Moral support. A weird expression. Was the assumption that people's morals needed showing up in time of stress, or was it moral of you to lend support? This was one of the many things that flew apart if you looked too closely. Across the road, above the green hills, the sky had turned black. She'd better take the clothes off the line and hang them in the woodshed. Paul had offered to get her a dryer, but Faye wouldn't have it. She was living in the country now, and she wanted that fresh smell. If he wanted to get her something, she said, he could start with a wicker clothes basket to replace that horrible green plastic one. A clothes basket, he said. Misunderstood provider was one of Paul's favorite roles these days. He was taking on the local accent, too, flattening certain sounds and giving others an odd depth. The A in farm was somewhere between the A in ah and the A in hat, while the I in wife was something like the ui in Huisman's. He had learned to treat the kitchen as a living room and to operate a chainsaw. He had his truck, which he had taken to calling his rig, and half a dozen adjustable caps, the front's thin foam rubber, the back's nylon mesh, which still smelled after they'd been through the wash. To have adopted such an aesthetic so convincingly was a real accomplishment for someone who knew perfectly well who Huisman's was. She had just got the still damp clothes safely into the woodshed when the sound of rain came up out of the silence as if somebody had turned up the volume. She walked to the open door and watched it pelt down in slanting gray lines through which waves of intensity swept back and forth. Already the driveway was a pair of muddy streams running side by side with a strip of grass between. Paul would be home early. The road crew certainly couldn't work in this. It looked so touching, rain falling on all that green, and she liked it in the woodshed, the rough-hewn beams, the sweet wood smell. When they first moved in, she'd found a box of shotgun shells out here on a shelf next to a can of motor oil. She brought the oil can to Paul, but threw out the shells without telling him, hiding them near the bottom of a trash bag. Then she'd worried for weeks that they might explode in the compactor at the transfer station. All in all, things were better up here. More coarse, yes, oafish locals sitting around her kitchen table, six-packs torn open. More coarse, less harsh. Was that a meaningful distinction? New York was harsh. After her divorce from Ben, she'd moved in with Karen on East 3rd Street. Because she had a thing about poison, she'd vacuumed up the boric acid Karen had put out and bought roach motels. A couple of days later, she picked up one to check inside, and it struck her that she was looking into hell. Tiny, starving creatures struggling to free themselves or just feebly waving their antennae. Later, when she took it up with her shrink, she could see that it was explicable as a projection of her guilt and not necessarily a message from God. But at the time, she'd screamed, and poor Karen had come running. It was sometime around then that Paul had come along, completely different from Ben, 180 degrees, which was exactly what she needed. Somebody completely right-brained. Or whichever side it was that made you verbal, as opposed to whatever Ben was, with a lot of books. Some of them the same as hers. A novel in progress, a funky old sob, and a failed marriage of his own. She'd gone to hear Cynthia Ozick at the 92nd Street Y and started chatting with this man in line who was wearing a nice-smelling leather jacket. When they announced that all the tickets were sold, everybody groaned, but he shrugged and said, "Minor disappointment. I'm not sure. I wouldn't rather have a drink anyway. Care to join me?" Karen had been greatly in favor of Paul. "You should grab him," she said. "I would." This sounded like a threat, but it turned out Karen wanted to move to California, but was afraid to go unless Faye had somebody. At first, it made no sense being in bed with this bearded man whose hair didn't smell like Ben's, or driving around up in the country staring at the fall colors out the windows of this man's sob. She looked through the slanting rain at the green hills. Beyond them was the long and winding road that led to Ben's door in Leavenworth, Washington. Then, down at the foot of the driveway, Paul's truck appeared, its lights on, edging close to the mailbox. She saw his arms stretch out of the window, pull open the box, and reach inside. Now he gunned it up the driveway toward the house and pulled onto the grass by the kitchen door. The wiper stopped, the headlights went out, and she watched him trot into the house, hugging the mail to his chest with one hand, his other elbow shielding his head from the rain. She listened to him, calling her name. For once, they got to eat in the dining room. Karen and Ellen had brought four bottles of a better-than-okay California Merlot and Cheez-Its, olives, and bread from Zabar's. Faye made sauce with her own tomatoes, which had just started to come in, and fresh pasta with her pasta machine. Paul's contribution was to keep the music going, though Faye thought she detected an edge of something when he put on Merle Haggard. He filled his wine glass again. They were already on bottle number 3, and claimed Merle Haggard looked like the King Hussein, which no one was prepared to dispute. "Okay, famous lookalikes," Paul said, "for 10 points, Mama Cass." "You mean think up somebody that looks like her?" Karen said. He nodded. "Famous writer." "Who was Mama Cass again?" said Alan. "Mamas and the Papas," Karen said. "They used to have their album when I was in 4th grade. "So 10 points, said Paul. "Looks just like her. Famous writer." He glanced around the table. "Would I know this person?" Alan said. "I'd hope so. You want another hit? 18th century. "You'll have to tell us," Karen said. "Samuel Johnson." "I don't see that at all," Karen said. "I'm not really familiar," Alan said. "Alan's more into John le Carré," said Karen. "Come on, I read good stuff too." "Nothing wrong with John le Carré," Paul said. "I'd a hell of a lot sooner read him than fucking John Updike if we're talking about Johns here." "You realize that's the second mean thing you've said about John Updike?" Karen said. "Why do you have such a thing about him?" Paul snorted. "I wonder." Faye swirled the sediment in her wine glass. Alcohol was so interesting, she thought. Interesting just to sit here with all this loud talk going on around you and yet to feel safe. She'd probably feel even safer lying down on the bed, and maybe in a while she'd get up, excuse herself, and go do just that. The dishes could wait until morning. No cockroaches here. And Paul could flirt with her sister all he wanted because Karen's husband was on hand. Hey, actually, I got one, Alan said. I'm thinking of somebody that looks just like Cecilia Bartoli. Who the hell is that? Said Paul. Cecilia Bartoli, the opera singer? Paul shrugged. I heard of the three tenors. That's what opera singers you get up here in the boonies. Now, what was this about? Paul never missed the Metropolitan Opera broadcast on Saturday afternoon unless his redneck friends were in the house. His old-time favorite tenor was Juicy Bjorley. But you get PBS, don't you? Alan said. Faye poured herself more wine, just a touch. Karen's husband was going too far with Paul, but she was too drunk to imagine how to warn him. I told you, Paul said, this is the fucking boonies, right? I like it to be the fucking boonies, because all that crap is interchangeable, you know? Spaghetti bender of the month. I mean, after a certain point, waving his hand, he knocked over the current wine bottle, then quickly righted it, leaving just a splash of maroon on the white tablecloth. Good hands, Alan said. So you give up? I don't give up, Paul said. I just don't happen to know what the hell you're talking about. I give up, Karen said, if that helps. Paul turned to her. You don't believe me about Samuel Johnson. Don't go anywhere. He got up and headed for the living room, walking surprisingly well. Does anybody want to hear my thing? Alan said. I do, Karen said. Faye took another sip. Your sister, he said. What? No way, said Karen. Okay, you're cut off. But it's true, he said. Am I crazy? Faye closed her eyes and began to count. Maybe to 50, she thought. There, check it out, she heard Paul say. She opened her eyes and saw him laying a book beside Karen's plate, a gray paperback whose cover showed a fat, peevish-looking, full-lipped man in a wig. Okay, Paul said. Now picture Mama Cass. I am, Karen said. I think you're as nuts as my husband. Faye closed her eyes again and considered proposing Richard Dreyfuss, but she couldn't tell if the game was over or not. Anyhow, it might take things someplace weird. What's it like for you living here? Karen said. They were walking up the path to where Faye knew there were blueberries, both swinging Medaglia d'Oro coffee cans. Faye had made holes in them with Paul's electric drill and attached pieces of clotheslines for handles. I don't know, Faye said. It's like, I don't know. I mean, it's like living any place, except it's, I don't know what to tell you. Sorry, Karen said. I didn't mean it to be a tough question. Oh, no, it's a legitimate question. I don't really think about it. I mean, is it better than the city? You know, sure, in some ways, having the space, plus just being able to just go out your back door. Alan and I talk about it sometimes, Karen said. I mean, we eventually do want to have kids, and it would be so much better in a place like this, but right now there's no way. You don't think? I bet if Alan played his cards right, he could get a job on the road crew. Right. How's Paul dealing with that? Faye shrugged. Like a pig deals with shit. He's running the grader, he's running the backhoe, the bush hog, whatever it all is, the big roller. Last winter, he was on night call for the snowplow. All he needs is a gun rack for the pickup. Is he doing anything on his book? Wasn't that part of the idea? His magnum opus? You never hear about it anymore. I assume it's fallen by the wayside. Karen shook her head. What a waste. I don't know, Faye said. Waste of what? He claims he's happy. Gets him outdoors, plenty of exercise. Hasn't he given you the whole rap? What about you, though? What about me? I'm here now. If I ever think of something else, I'll think of something else. There aren't any other papers or anything? Sure, this is the land of opportunity. Can't think why everybody isn't up here. They climbed over a tumble-down stolen wall into a field of thigh-high saplings. A jay screamed. Faye squatted and stretched out her hand, palm up to touch one leaf in a patch of low, tidy-looking bushes. A blueberry bush, she said, pronouncing the article like the letter A. God, look at them all, said Karen, getting down on her bare knees. You aren't kidding. No, not my style. You can pick here. I'll hit the other side. The first berries started pinging into the coffee cans, then only the rustling of the bushes as their hands tore at the berries and the screams of the jays. So quiet here, Karen said. I actually had trouble getting to sleep with nothing but the katydids. Yeah, said Faye. This is the time of year you start hearing them. I still have trouble myself. It's like the one thing stands out more when there's just silence, though I personally didn't hear jack shit last night. I bet. I was worried you might be sick, but Paul said you're okay. Paul should know. Karen shot her a glance. Are you guys fighting? That's a quaint enough way to put it. No. Oh, Karen went back to picking and then stopped and stared at Faye. At the risk of being put down definitively, she said, I would like to note that A, I'm your sister, B, you do not seem happy, and C, if something's wrong, I'd be glad to listen. Faye shook her head. It's not really any one thing, just the usual. Well, I know I shouldn't ask this, Karen began. No, you shouldn't. Whatever it is, I'll tell you one thing. About 65% of the problem is that I'm hung over, and this sun is giving me a headache. We must have about enough. Let me see what you've got. Karen tilted her coffee can toward Faye. Well, not quite. We want to make two pies, and these things cook down. You make them in twos? The frugal Hausfrau, Faye said. Cost money to run that gas stove, you know. Actually, one is for you guys to take with you. Really? No, Faye said. I'm kidding you again. By the time they got back to the house, they were both sweating. But it was cool in the kitchen. Karen lifted the tightly rolled bandana from around her head and shook her hair with both hands. It struck Faye that she'd only seen this style in magazines. Then it struck her that Karen obviously had been wearing the bandana all morning. Okay, if you'll wash these, I'll start the pie crust, she said, opening the cabinet and handing Karen the colander. What happened to the boys? Karen said, looking out the window. I don't see the truck. They probably went someplace to measure cocks with the locals. Saturday in Vermont. You go buy a case of beer, then you go over to somebody's house and watch him work on his car. Paul is nothing if not assimilated. Alan must be in seventh heaven, Karen said. He'll have some real Americana to lay on everybody back at Time Warner. So is Paul serious about all this, or is he just collecting material? Material for a beer belly, maybe, which he's already getting. I don't know. You'd have to understand Paul. Question is, does anybody want to understand Paul? Well, you, presumably. Right, Faye said. There's always me. Listen. Let's get these pies in the oven and maybe we can go for a swim. That would be great. Karen poured blueberries from the coffee cans into the colander, began running water, then turned the faucet off. Wait, why am I doing this? Don't get philosophical on me. I mean, what are we washing off? They don't use insecticide up there in the woods, do they? Faye looked out the window. How would anybody know? If it's not insecticide, it's acid rain or God knows what. The deer come through and piss on them. I don't know. Actually, I think New York's the only place a nature lover should really live. Put up your Ansel Adams calendar and you're in business. She dug the measuring cup into the bag of flour, held her palm against the outside of the bag to level it off, and dumped the flour into the mixing bowl. Could you get down the Wesson oil up in that cupboard? Karen stood on tiptoes and craned her neck, tilting bottles to look behind them. Canola oil? Sorry, that's what I meant. See, this isn't the boonies. A mere 20 miles to the nearest supermarket. Faye measured oil into the cup and dumped it over the floor. Over the flour, not the floor. Then she held the cup under the faucet and measured water. Are you sure this is going to work? Karen said. I thought you were supposed to mix the oil and water first and then keep adding flour to it. It all ends up together anyhow, said Faye. I can't put it together. It is together. She measured out salt and baking powder. Okay, we need room on that counter to roll this stuff up. Have you picked over those berries? Karen started moving junk off the counter. You got amazing counter space, she said. Even on the west side, the kitchens really aren't big enough. Counter space, Faye said. Sounds like what's inside a black hole. She fluttered her fingers and intoned the word in Twilight Zone baritone. Counter space. Karen laughed. There's a rolling pin in that drawer, Faye said. By the fridge? God, I actually own a rolling pin. If I had a bathrobe and curlers, I could give the boys a real American welcome. This really is America, isn't it? Said Karen. The women folk in the kitchen and the boys out God knows where. Is this really what it's like here? Honey, Faye said in her hillbilly voice. This right here is just the top of the iceberg of what it's like, yeah? It's the unstable surface through which the unwary... Now she slipped into her black radio preacher voice and was rolling her eyes. Is liable to fall at any instant. My sister, Karen was laughing again. Faye stopped and looked out the window. I don't know, she said in her own voice. It's a good question. I really have no idea what it's like here. Faye sat on the bed and dug her right heel into her left heel to work her shoe off without having to untie it, pried the other shoe off with the bare toes of her left foot, and stretched out on top of the quilt. She told Karen she was still feeling iffy, given her a towel, and explained how to get down to the brook. She was going to lie down for half an hour, take the pies out, and maybe afterward she'd come join her. But the hangover was only part of it. She hadn't seen Karen in, what, 4 years? Shouldn't she be able to endure 2 days? It was quarter after one. She could nap until quarter of two, take the pies out, pick up around the house a little. That still left a lot of hours. She made a fist and started sticking out fingers. Quarter three, four, five, six, God, 9 or 10 more hours today, and at least another, what, 5 or 6 tomorrow. A minimum of 14 more hours, and you've only gotten through, let's see, maybe 4 hours last night and 3 or 4 today, like a third of the way through. She closed her eyes and started watching for the crazy thought, the one that meant she was asleep, although examining each thought to see if it was crazy made it harder for the crazy one to come. She realized she was clenching her eyelids, relaxed them, and felt her face get longer all the way down to her chin. Her jaw dropped, her teeth parted. This was the way your face needed to feel if you were to receive the crazy thought. She went down through her body, checking for tensions. She found it, then relaxed it in the neck, in the shoulders, in the stomach, in the buttocks, in the thighs, in the knees, in the feet. What was the term for them? Those head-to-toe descriptions of women in medieval literature in which lovers itemized their ladies' attractions. English 242, Beowulf to Chaucer, a seminar room with cinder block walls and windows you pulled down to open, like an oven door, except they stopped at an acute angle. Outside, blue sky, trees starting to turn, fall semester, her junior year, first day of class. She waited to learn what name he would answer to, the one with the violin case and the wrinkled Oxford shirt and the full lower lip, unsmiling. Then 3 unforgivable weeks of catching his eye and simpering. In those days, Ben practiced 6 hours at a stretch, and he dropped the class before midterms. But by that time, well, not what you want to be thinking about. This much was clear. She had been married to him, but he had never been married to her. It had all been an invasion of his privacy, and it had meant nothing the time he'd come with her to the vets to have poor, sick, old Bootsy put down on a plastic sofa in a waiting room that stank of disinfectant. He turned to her and said, "There's always me." So when he left and she learned that he was still growing inside her, she'd had him uprooted. She was still uprooting him every day. She checked for tension again, found clenched fists. So puzzling that after being in this body for 30-odd years, you still don't know how to shut it down. Yet somehow it happens. The crazy thought comes, and that's the last thing you know. Faye set the pies on the counter and turned off the oven. She felt worse for having slept. The inside of her stomach tasted foul, and a pinpoint of headache was coming and going high on the left side of her forehead. She washed the mixing bowls and the rolling pin, ran water through the colander, wiped off the countertop. She took Paul's book off the dining room table and reshelved it in the living room between the golden bowl and the penal colony. Down at the brook, Karen was sitting against the big beech tree, her hair wet, her shorts and t-shirt dry. "Hi," said Faye, seating herself on the big rock. "Looks like you found it okay. How's the water?" "Muddy, but nice. You going in?" "No, I was being polite. What are you reading?" Karen held up Jung's Answer to Job. "Yikes! How is it?" "Muddy, entertaining in a weird way. He's trying to psychoanalyze God, I think." She picked up a beech leaf to mark her place and set the book on the ground. "You are being polite." "Okay," Faye said, "I'll stop. If you want Paul, you can have him." "What?" "Oh, shit. Forget I said it. Please? Sometimes I just get the impulse to say something completely insane just to see what happens next." "Faye, what is this? Why would you think?" Faye shook her head. "You don't get it. I mean, I don't blame you." She stood up and brushed off the seat of her jeans. "I'm sorry, Karen. Really. Look, it would be a mistake to take me seriously. Really, I just say things all the time now." Karen got up and put an arm around Faye's shoulders. "You're not really doing so hot, are you?" Faye shook her head. Karen moved in front of her to put both arms around her. Faye twisted away. "Really, don't. Karen, just please don't." She walked to the edge of the brook and squatted to put a hand in the water. "Too cold," she said. "You about ready for a drink? It must be almost happy hour." "Look, would it be better if Alan and I left tonight? If we can't change our plane tickets, there must be a bus or something." "Karen, no, really, absolutely not. Could you just forget it? Just..." She cut through the air with her hand at chest level. "Canceled. Really. Okay? Do you want to tell me what this is about? It's not about Paul." "No," Faye said, "I guess it's not about Paul. Poor Paul. Then again, poor Paul can take care of himself." Karen looked at the water. "I was going to ask you before if you still heard anything from Ben. Card on my birthday with a note. There was a shitty day. Where is he?" "Leavenworth, Washington. I looked it up on the map. The nearest big place is Wenatchee. It's on Route 2, which happens to be the same Route 2 that goes through Burlington. What you came here on. He said he's living in a cabin and building violins. I assume he's there with somebody. He said he still thinks about me." "Bastard," Karen said. "I don't know," Faye said. "Yeah, sure. On the other hand, why not say what you feel like saying? It's just that it's so fucking unfair. I mean, I have to take Route 2 to get to the fucking supermarket." "Listen," said Karen, "just one piece of sisterly advice and I'll shut up, okay?" Faye shrugged. "Shoot. Wouldn't it be better all around if you just let go of him and tried to repair what you've got with Paul?" "You're right. Absolutely right. Now, shall we go get that drink? Time's a-wastin'." Faye stood up and motioned with her thumb. Karen sighed and followed her up the path. They'd gotten all the way up the road when Karen said, "Crap, my book. You don't have to wait for me." She started back down the path and Faye watched the sunlight and shadow make zebra stripes on her long legs until she disappeared into the trees. Faye ducked through the fence between the strands of barbed wire, pushing the top one up away from her hair and her back and keeping her calves clear of the bottom one. Then she straightened up, looked across the road at the house and saw Paul's truck parked in the dooryard alongside Thurston Martin's. She decided to pick wildflowers and wait for Karen. She gathered a few Indian paintbrushes and black-eyed Susans and was looking for ferns to set them off when Karen came squirming through the fence. "Lucky you," Faye said. "You get to see the Thurston Martin show." Karen fanned herself with her book. "Will I like it?" "De gustibus non est disputandum, as Thurston might say." She could smell cigarette smoke through the screen door. The three men were sitting at the kitchen table. Faye said, "Hello, Thurston," and breezed past to get a mason jar for the flowers. Then, remembering her manner, she turned to introduce her sister and saw Karen staring. A shotgun lay across the table on top of its zippered case among the beer cans. One, unopened, had the plastic thing still attached. 5 empty circles. No opera today. "Oh, for a camera," Faye said. Wouldn't I give Diane Arbus a run for her money? Paul's face was red, maybe from the sun, maybe from drinking. Thurston's going to sell me a shotgun, he said. His accent got thicker when Thurston was around. They shot him a quick, fake smile. Oh, and what will Thurston do for a shotgun? Hell, I got two or three over to the house, Thurston said. This one here, this used to belong to my father. He took a last drag of his cigarette and stuck it into a beer can. Hiss. What do you intend to do with a shotgun, Paul? Shoot hippies? Thurston laughed. It's hunting season coming up, Paul said, and I've been thinking it might not be a bad idea to have something around anyway, just in general. In general, Faye said. Plus that woodchuck's been at your garden. Christ, said Thurston, who pronounced it to rhyme with floor joist. You don't want to go after him with a shotgun. Tear up the friggin' plants. You want a 22 if you're looking for a varmint gun. Oh, do get a varmint gun, Faye said. You could get rid of all the undesirables. Hey, Alan, Karen said. Come here a second. I have to show you what Faye's been doing in the garden. Alan looked puzzled, but he stood up and Faye watched them walk out the screen door, hand in hand, Karen in her little shorts. She turned back to the table and saw Thurston looking. That's your sister, he said, wrenching the plastic off the last beer. That's right, Faye said, and if we were all as diplomatic as my sister, I could be talking with Paul right now. Thurston popped the beer open, stood up, and looked at Paul. You want me to... He pointed his thumb at the shotgun. Just leave it, said Paul. Be outside, Thurston said. When the screen door slapped behind him, Faye said, I won't have that in the house. You can tell your friend the sale is off. The hell's this, Paul said. It's not your money. You sit in the goddamn house feeling sorry for yourself while I'm on the goddamn truck all day. So you don't tell me. What is this, the working man's blues? Give me a break, Paul. I mean, this is a game. We live in this house because you closed out an IRA and plunked down $50,000. So don't hand me this Merle Haggard bullshit. Oh, you think it's a game? We come here on the strength of God knows what. You get laid off and you decide to have a breakdown. Where exactly do you think the mortgage payments come from every month? Not from you. You'll have to think you're a helpless victim, she said, because it absolves you of any and all responsibility. I love to think I'm a victim. And then you get to say, she's a castrating bitch. She humiliated me in front of my friends, and everybody is so sympathetic. Why don't you go out and talk to Karen? I'm sure she's just dying, just itching to listen to all your little marital problems. Paul stared at her. You're psychotic, he said. Oh, he's talking better all of a sudden. Are we dropping the mask? What happened to the working class hero? She stuck out her lips and put on a deep voice. You got it, bitch? Okay, he said. End of discussion. I am buying this gun from Thurston. Clear? Paul, they said. In view of everything, do you really think it's a good idea to have a gun in this house? Fine, he said. I'll keep it in the truck. How's that? I'll go the whole route. Gun rack and everything. That way you can have the pleasure of complaining to your sister I've gone native. She gave him the finger and then said, it smells in here. Out in the garden, she found Karen and Alan, her arm around his waist, talking with Thurston Martin, who was squatting by one of the zucchini plants. The three heads turned and Thurston got to his feet, dangling his beer can between fingertips and opposable thumb. Just saying you might have to pick some of these big ones, he said. Thanks for your concern, Thurston, Faye said. You can go back in now. The little woman has been put in her place. Thurston looked at her and then started for the house. Faye, said Karen, Alan, I think we should head back tonight. Alan's got a bunch of work to do before Monday. Oh, Faye said. Should I be gracious? That's clearly what's called for here. Alan looked at the ground. Karen said, he really does have work, and it doesn't seem as if our being here is helping things any. I mean, we obviously didn't pick a very good time. Well, aren't you diplomatic, Faye said. Not really, Karen said, but I just want you to know, if you ever feel like coming down either by yourself or... Yeah, well, thanks. Look, you're both handling this very smoothly, and old Faye intends to hold up her end. I'll tell Paul what's going on so you don't have to go through all that again. He can drive you over to Burlington, we'll find a shopping bag so you can carry that pie, and we'll just have this whole thing together in no time. Faye, I'm really sorry. Oh, come on, she said. Come on. Come on. You're joking, taking this way too seriously. This will all blow over. You guys can come back in December and we'll have an old-fashioned Christmas. What do you say? Paul can kill us a goose with his shotgun and we'll sit around and drink smoking bishop. Faye sat on the doorstep looking across the road. She'd listened and listened, following the sound of the truck into silence. By now it had been silent for God knows how long. Here and there the scream of a jay, and that was all. She tried to wish that if the truck were going to crash, it would wait to crash on the way back so only Paul would die. It wasn't actually a heavy thing, wishing people dead. She had learned this during analysis. Everybody did it. Obvious example, children wishing their parents dead. Of course, they feel guilty if that wish should appear to come true. The child's angry with the parents coincidentally die in a car crash. Then they need to enter analysis to straighten out the misunderstanding. But what about when parents wish their children dead? These are not children, her shrink had said when she told him about her abortion. He'd said it angrily, unless she'd misperceived. Quality of the life, that was his concern. We are physicians, he had said, full of indignation at human suffering. In his work with teenage mothers, he'd seen what damage could be done. So it all went around and around and around. Down the driveway, beyond the mailbox, across the road, the land dipped down to the brook, then rose again to a grassy hillside, belonging to somebody. Paul must have said the name 100 times. Those black and white cows stood in a complicated arrangement against the green. The phrase effictio portrait came into her head. Above the pasture, the wooded hilltop, a deeper green in which she already saw flecks of red. It was crazy to pretend that she didn't. Strange and terrible powers were available to us, no matter what her shrink had said. But in most cases, you could wish and wish and wish. Wish people dead, wish the leaves green again, wish your husband, your real husband, back in your arms, and babies beyond number issuing from between your legs, while everything just stayed silent and inert, exactly as it was. She stood up, went back inside. Her wildflowers lay on the kitchen counter. Better get them in water. She lowered her palm above the remaining pie until she felt heat, then edged it back up, feeling for the boundary where the heat left off. Then she walked over to the table and touched the shotgun, still lying on top of its fake leather case. She touched the stock, then the barrel. Why should metal feel colder than wood? She couldn't imagine an explanation that wasn't mystical. At least touching this thing took away some of the awe. After all, it was just an object. Its presence probably wouldn't change things much, unless you allowed it to become an emblem of something. She sat down at the table and started lifting the beer cans, found one that was nearly full, examined the edge of the hole for cigarette traces, sniffed, took a sip. It was so quiet in here that her whole body jerked when the phone rang. She jumped up to get it. Then she sat back down and let it ring and ring and ring, thinking, as long as I don't pick it up, It isn't anybody. That story was called The Crazy Thought by David Gates. From the collection The Wonders of the Invisible World, published by Alfred A. Knopf in 1999. Well, you've been listening to me, Norman Douglas, on Goodnight Norman. I think I have 3 minutes left. What should I do? Talk to you like I know what I'm talking about? Oh my goodness, I have 5 minutes left. Maybe I'll torture you with one of my really short stories. I think I've got an old one. I think I wrote this 4 or 5 years ago. It's called Half Rabbit, Half Dog. We saw each other every day and every night for years. I had a slew of names I called Lana, like Lonnie Pants and Land Rover and Lana Bonana and Lonnie Punani and Lanky Master and 1,000 other things I came up with for no reason other than to keep smiling and laughing like fun was a crime and we were rebels without a care. Of course, we were so careless, things turned reckless long before we both knew we had to be careful. I never said so, and neither did she, but you know there was other motherfuckers talking and making big shite. Fuck 'em, she said, and I said so too. At a bonfire night outside of town, Damien got loud about Lana. She stood up from the big log a bunch of other people were also sitting on, passing whiskey and weed. She said, "Fuck this shit," and started for the house. Damien pointed at her and howled. When he stopped, an owl hooted from the trees, standing round the edge of the big pond. Bobby said, "Fuck an owl." The coyotes got to yelping on cue. Much farther away. "Fucking coyotes!" roared Damien. Lana stopped in mid-track and turned and yelled, "Fucking bitch, fuck you, you fuck!" Peepers and crickets and snap-crackling wood was the only next sound. Then Marissa said, "Damn!" I found Lana in the kitchen in the house. A fire was glowing in the living room fireplace where Jasmine and Jake were making out and finger-fucking like teenagers do. I walked past and sat across from the bestie. "Motherfucker," she said, "what the fuck?" I rubbed my eyes with the heels of my palms for as long as it took to feel like my head felt different inside than when I started. When I stopped finally, Lana was looking at me quizzically and said, "What the fuck was that about?" on top of her swivel and crane of her neck for emphasis, and added without missing a beat, "Is there any whiskey?" I shrugged at the same time as Jake must have come up for air in the living room to say, "You freeloaders better leave her parents' liquor alone. They'll be pissed." Lana's jaw dropped and her eyes went saucer-sized and probably her muscles got tight and then loose like a slingshot rubber band action because she sprang out her seat after it seemed she crouched over Jake. Jasmine, meanwhile, knocked out, stretched cold on the Oriental or Persian rug between the unkempt ottoman and the dilapidated davenport. Lonnie Pants looking like bleach blonde Vampirella from the back, the way her feet planted on his thighs. She curled her neck round the corner of Jake's head and snarled and lunged and shook until she tore away and whipped her skull and